This presentation has been previously broadcast.
The issues that matter most, right here. The Drew Mariani Show
on Relevant Radio.
While Florida public schools will soon start the day a bit differently, Governor Ron DeSantis signing a bill into law this week requiring schools now to have a moment of silence of up to 2 minutes during first period.
The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
I know a lot of people are very impressed by Governor DeSantis and what he's doing. That report comes from ABC 25 in Florida. You're going to hear more about that story in a moment. But first, I want to welcome you. It's great to be here with you this afternoon, as always. Get comfortable. We've got 3 hours to spend together. We got a lot to talk about. There's a lot of news, a lot of important moral issues for you and I to kind of make our way through. And I hope you can hang out with me for that period of time. Let's start with the good news. This Governor DeSantis, Governor Ron DeSantis from Florida, I personally think he's going to be running for president. I think he's got a good shot, too. I think he's what he's doing in Florida and how he is defending life and liberty. I think he's had a pretty good shot. I think he's going to resonate with a lot of people. But we'll see. That's still a long way off. We'll see who throws her hat in the ring. But he signed a bill. He signed a bill into law that requires first period teachers at all public schools in the state to have at least a minute of silence so that students can pray or meditate. Wow. Now, when I heard that story, I thought, where's the Freedom from Religion organization that hails, I think, from Madison, Wisconsin? I'm sure they're going to be all over him. I'm sure they're going to be coming. But ABC 25 has a little bit more on this new mandate from Florida, from Governor DeSantis, I really should say. Listen to what he said.
Now, the law covers all K through 12 public school classrooms. Keep in mind, teachers cannot recommend what students do with that 2 minutes of their time, but parents are encouraged to talk with their children about it.
We have an opportunity here to really protect the religious freedom of everybody who's going to school K through 12 in the state of Florida, and we're really proud of that.
There can be unintended consequences of students who are going to be in situations where they can't leave, and yet they are vulnerable and ostracized for not participating.
Under the measure, students may not interfere with each other's participation in that moment of silence. It officially goes into effect July 1st.
Oh, it's such a silly comment. Oh, students can't leave. It's 60 seconds. It's 1 minute of silence. Come on. So, they want their safe space, right? It's so silly. When I went to school, we'd pledge allegiance to the flag, and we'd pray. It was a very different time. Governor DeSantis, he said at the signing this, and I thought it was telling. He says, it's something that's important to be able to provide each student the ability every day to be able to reflect and to be able to pray as they see fit. The idea, he said, that you should just push God out of every institution and be successful. He said, I'm sorry, our founding fathers did not believe that. And I think he's absolutely right. I mean, we have stripped God from every corner of the public square. Even in places like the Grand Canyon, it has been removed. Ten Commandments removed from courthouses, from our schools. I should actually talk to you a little bit about what happened when we removed God from schools, Madeline O'Hare, and what that has led to. So I just say bravo to you, Governor DeSantis. I'm delighted. The new law says that teachers can't make suggestions to students about what they'll reflect on during the moment of silence. So say there was a school shooting or something happened in the world, they can't say, well, pray for that or reflect on that. They've got to remain quiet. But Florida now is not the first state to do this. You might be surprised. 15 other states have very similar laws. So Governor DeSantis is not the first there. China, Governor President Biden is meeting with Vladimir Putin, as you probably have seen today. And we'll talk a little bit about that coming up later, Russia, U.S. relations. But China, I just want to keep them on your radar. I've been monitoring what's happening with them, and there's a situation, a dangerous situation right now that is happening. And pray for China for their safety. There's a leak, not a lab leak, like what happened in Wuhan, right? But a leak from a nuclear power station. And a French company that owns a nuclear power plant located near Hong Kong and some of the other cities, they've reported that there had been a leak of certain gases and that there are indicators that all is not well at the facility. CNN has more on this story. they reported on what happened when they reached out to Chinese officials. By the way, they got no response.
The U.S. government is assessing reports of a possible leak at a Chinese nuclear power plant after the French company that owns part of it and operates it warned of a, quote, imminent radiological threat. Now, at the center of concern is the Taishan nuclear power plant located in Guangdong province in southern China, which is home to more than 126 million people. The Biden administration believes the facility is not yet at a, quote, crisis level. The U.S. has been in contact with Chinese and French governments, and multiple U.S. government agencies are also, we understand.
So far, nothing more has been reported. China, of course, has downplayed any reports saying that, you know, everything was normal. And then that's what happened last year in January when reports about a strange new phenomenon started leaking out of China. There are 65 million people, 65 million, who live just in the vicinity of this nuclear power plant. So again, there are brothers, there are sisters. Let's pray for their safety. They certainly need it. These situations should give us all pause. Today, you know what today is? One final quick note here. I think this is a date that may not have been on your radar in the past. Big date today, right? It's Juneteenth. I don't like that, to be honest. I don't like the way that sounds. Juneteenth, the 16th of June, right? Juneteenth. And, of course, it's the day when the Union Army arrived in Galveston, Texas. They declared that all slaves were free. And even though Abraham Lincoln, 2 years earlier, had written the Emancipation Proclamation, it took that long. It took, you know, over 24 months to get through all the states. And yesterday, the Senate unanimously passed a bill that would make Juneteenth a federal holiday. And there's also a companion bill in the House, and that's still waiting for a final vote. But what's the backstory? You may not be familiar with Juneteenth. You might wonder what it's all about. You'll probably be hearing a lot more of it in your future. Here's a great explanation from Our America on the historic date and ultimately how the flag came about.
Red, white, and blue, the colors of the American flag, but they also grace the face of another quintessential American banner, the official flag of Juneteenth. The red, white, and blue colors and the images on the flag reinforce that the enslaved black people freed by the Emancipation Proclamation were Americans, as much as their descendants are today. But that's not where the Juneteenth flag symbolism ends. The date, June 19, 1865, is a day that the enslaved men, women, and children in Galveston finally received the word that they had been freed, a declaration made 2 years earlier. Since Texas is the birthplace of Juneteenth, the Lone Star State is represented by the star at the heart of the flag. The burst surrounding the star depicts the image of a nova, a new star, symbolizing a new beginning for black Americans. That symbolism is shared with the arc, the curved line, or new horizon, that separates the banner's red and blue sections. The flag has flown since 1997 and remains a proud symbol of black freedom in the United States of America.
And again, today, Juneteenth, the 16th of June. Hey, just a follow-up, one final story here for you that I thought you would appreciate, as I get a lot of news that comes across my desk. We've talked about Nickelodeon in the past, right? We've talked about how there is an ideological movement to target our children, right? And I think it's much larger than just an ideology. I think it's a spiritual thing. And there's fallout from it. And we've talked about Nickelodeon. I don't know if you and your kids are watching Nickelodeon. Just consider yourself to be part of a waning minority if you are watching it. The Daily Wire had a piece. They reported that since July of 2017, Nickelodeon's viewership, it has dropped from 1.3 million average viewers per week. 1.3 million. Get that number. Okay, I want to give you another number. 1.3 million average viewers per week to a June 2021 average of only 372,000. I mean, that's a big drop. Now, the reason you know, I think most likely has to do with the focus on the LGBTQ stuff. I really do. I think parents don't want their kids exposed to it. And bravo to you parents who say, you know what? You're not watching this. There's other choices. We can stream stuff. We can put stuff in our DVR. We can do whatever we have to do, right? We can watch it on our DVR. Hey, 1.3 million in about 48 months down to 372,000. The suits at Nickelodeon must be pretty concerned. I mean, that's for sure. Again, I think it has to do with pushing LGBTQ, you know, ideology on young kids who are developing and, you know, who should not be exposed to that stuff at such an early age. You know, when they're transforming a show like Blue's Clues, right? Blue's Clues into a gay pride advertisement. That's not going to go over well with parents. It shouldn't go over well with parents. Our kids watched Blue's Clues. Blue's Clues is now a gay pride advertisement. Come on. So I don't know what you do. Do you let your kids watch, Nick? You may not, after hearing what Stinchfield said about the network on Newsmax. Listen to this.
I'm going to give you a doozy. It seems like Nickelodeon has gone off the deep end. I don't understand what it is with not that I'm anything against gay people, whatever it may be, but their transgender indoctrination to kids is just out in left field. Watch this video from Nickelodeon. Do you understand the amount of questions parents are going to get after that? I don't get what it is, Isabella. Do you?
No, and it's a really, I just can't imagine it being anything besides some sinister motives. But something that really bothers me is I don't hate, like you said, I don't have a problem with gay people. I don't care about transgender people. My problem is that you're shoving it down everyone's throats. And I reject any Pride Month that is just celebrating identity politics. That is bigotry. And that's why I don't like the idea of a Pride Month, whether it's for any sort of topic or identity group. So this is creepy and makes me never want to have kids because I don't want to bring them into a world where this is being pushed on them, and it's scary.
That's sad in some respects. I hear a lot of people say the same thing. Oh, it makes me not want to have kids. Hey, be open to life. Your kids can make a difference, right? If you're a good parent and you instill in them those good moral values, never underestimate the power you have on your children. Yes, the culture is powerful, but the seeds you plant, the sacrifices you offer, the prayers you blanket them in, that has profound impact. Anyway, one of the numbers we were talking during the last break, Jake and I, about this, you know, these diminishing Nickelodeon numbers. I think it's this ideology that's being put on them. But also there's a lot of cable cutting going on right now. Cable itself could be on its way out. A lot of people are saying streaming services began to dominate, you know, a lot of people's viewing entertainment. Also, just a quick programming note. I said today is June 16th, and a day that commemorates the Union Army's when they arrived in Galveston, Texas. My call screener today, Nick, just told me, hey, it's June 19th is the day that happened. So I'll look into that as well, but I'll go with my team. They've researched that and said June 19th is Juneteenth. You guys double check that for me. I could have sworn it was the 16th, but I'll trust you. All right. Hey, coming up in a second, Wesley Smith is going to be stopping by. One other thing happening on Capitol Hill. There was a bill that got passed through the Senate last week. It was touted as helping to build America back better. You know, and the United States Innovation and Competition Act was voted out of the Senate by 68-32, and it now goes to the House. The bill is supposed to help the United States compete against China in the global marketplace by funding all kinds of technological innovations, and I hope it does, including, in the fact they're going to be focusing on biotechnology. Of course, this can be a troubling field, because it comes with problematic ethical issues. And one of the issues that has developed over the last 20 years or so is mixing up human and animal cells. And that's being done, for instance, when, here's an example, let's just say surgeons put a pig heart valves into humans to replace defective valves, right? That happens on a pretty regular basis. But there are also some really strange things that are happening that are just, you know, they're outright gruesome. Like mixing human genes with mouse embryos. impact report laid out just how progressive, how radical this chimera research has become. Listen to this.
It's a tale as old as civilization and probably older. The human animal chimera. From the minotaur of King Minos to the fly of Jeff Goldblum, we are simultaneously fascinated and horrified at the possibility of bridging the gap between humankind and wild beasts. To be fair, science fiction has outpaced science fact in this regard, but human-animal chimeras have been created, though never until now, in as advanced a state as is reported in this paper appearing in Cell, which has pushed our ethical envelope farther than ever before, and will force us all to grapple with some really fundamental questions, like what it means to be human. The headlines write themselves, of course. Human monkey chimera created is, well, now technically not hyperbole. But let's be really clear about how this set of experiments worked and how they were different from what went on before. Chimeras, single life forms with cells bearing different genotypes, are everywhere. You need look no further than your local florist to find chimeric roses, for example. And human chimeras, individuals with at least some cells having a different genotype, probably an absorbed twin, were documented as early as 1953. But interspecies chimeras, in the animal kingdom at least, are a bit of a hurdle. Species that are relatively closely related can chimerize more easily. One of the first successes was a sheep-goat chimera documented in Nature in 1984. What about mules and ligers bred for their skills and magic? No, they are hybrids, not chimeras. They have a single genotype, albeit contributed by parents of two different species, as opposed to multiple genotypes in one organism.
Now, here's somebody who's been following this, reporting on it for a long time. He's a blogger at National Review's National Review Online's The Corner, I should say. The author of The Culture of Death, The Age of Do-Harm Medicine. And I know you have listened to Wesley Smith many times in the past. And you follow him on Twitter at The Wesley J. Smith. And it's good to have him with us today. Wesley, good afternoon.
Hey, Drew. How are you?
Good. Thank you for your patience today. It's good to have you with us.
No problem.
Something you've been writing about, reporting on, following. Why is there a push to fuse animal and human cells? I mean, give me your take on what we're now seeing, and maybe you can explain what a chimera is, if there's even a definition for it.
Oh, sure. Chimera is simply an organism with the cells or genes of two different types of species. And in and of itself, chimeric research, even using human cells, is not necessarily bad. Just give you an example. They've done some work in pigs to try to change the genome of pigs with some human cells so that potentially pig organs could be used for transplant in the same way, as you mentioned, pig valves are, which could greatly alleviate the organ shortage that we have in terms of organ transplant medicine, because pig organs are strikingly similar to human organs. The problem becomes if you start changing the nature of the animal into more of a human kind of nature. Particularly the concern would be, in terms of brain cells, putting stem cells into monkey embryos, which I'm afraid they've done, and then potentially starting to have primates that also have some human capacities in terms of brain cells and so forth. Because you do not want to, an ethical line that should be hard and fast, it seems to me, is to kind of what they call elevate an animal from its own nature, inherent nature, into a more of a human nature, which would be devastating in terms of morality, but would also be cruel to the animal. I mean, if the animal was self-aware, for example, that it was a completely, novel creation of human scientists, it would be terrible. On the other hand, and I hate to be equivocal, but sometimes you have to be, do we want to stop and outlaw the research that I mentioned on pigs? I don't think so. The problem we have is that most of this area is self-regulated by the scientists. The scientists say, well, let us decide what the regulations are. You can trust us. Well, I don't think you can trust the scientists, quote unquote, to have the proper ethics necessarily. And let me give you an example. This was written up in Nature. They did a study of, they wanted to do a study on skin infections. So what they took were 18 to 20 week gestated fetuses that had died in an abortion. Drew, I'm sorry to say this, but they literally scalped them.
Ugh.
And then they grafted the scalps onto rats and conducted their experiment. And the journal article in Nature has photos of rats capped with human hair and the scalp of these destroyed babies. That got all of that went through all of the what's called the internal the review boards, the institutional review boards, IRBs at the university. This is at the University of Pittsburgh. It got approved for the animal rights stuff. It got approved for fetal tissue stuff and so forth. Well, I personally find that utterly grotesque and gruesome. And if you want to do experiments on dealing with skin infections, you do it a different way. That shows you that there is a huge disconnect from what the biotechnologists think is ethical and what I think millions and millions of Americans and the people around the world would think of as ethical. So we can, and every major and powerful institution needs checks and balances. Nothing is more powerful than biotech. It is the most powerful technology developed since the splitting of the atom. And it seems to me that there needs to be really hands-on direct regulation, international of these kinds of experiments, because if there isn't, let's say we stop something here in the United States, well, the scientists will just go to China, which is where ethics goes to die, you know?
Yeah, right. So, Wesley, what's being funded with this particular bill right now that's being proposed? What exactly are they doing?
Well, the bill is kind of, you're dealing with an indirect issue here. The NIH currently does not fund chimeric research. There was a proposal back in 2015, 2016 to do that. It never went forward. It's still up on the website of the NIH and so forth. So at least at the moment, this kind of chimeric research is not being funded, particularly with the stem cell issues and so forth, embryonic stem cells. I checked in terms of this particular article that came out. And the law that they're talking about isn't directly NIH. It's a different kind of funding mechanism with a different department. And some of the existing laws are something called the Wicker-Dickey Amendment that prevents embryos, for example, from being created for the purpose of destroying them and using them on research. Doesn't prevent that from happening, but prevents federal funding.
Right.
This comes in the Department of, I think it's Department of Labor, which doesn't have the Dickey Wicker funding restrictions in it, although usually the funding, the ethical boards follow what the NIH does. Mm-hmm. And I think it also illustrates another problem. We've got far too many departments and agencies in this country that kind of deal with the same areas, and that makes it harder to regulate them in terms of ethics. But science needs humility and it needs ethics if it's truly going to be beneficent. And the scientists can't decide on their own.
Wesley, if people want to read your writing on this, what's the best way to connect?
If they follow me on Twitter @TheWesleyJSmith, I'm about to have actually a large article on that touches on this.
Awesome.
In Epic Times, it'll be out any time now. And I also write at National Review online at The Corner.
Thank you. That's Wesley J. Smith. I'll be right back.
Catholic Order of Foresters is proud to sponsor the Relevant Radio Studio line. For information about employment opportunities and flexible premium life insurance plans, visit relevantradio.com/Forester.
Hey, hi, Drew. Thanks for taking my call.
All the issues.
Has also been a victim of vandalism now.
All the topics.
Prevent these things.
One place. The Drew Mariani Show.
But we have to cooperate with prayer.
On Relevant Radio. We go there.
Well, good to be back here with you today. Facebook, they announced recently that they're going to allow 60,000 employees to continue working from home with the whole pandemic thing now being kind of behind us. So I don't know where you are. I mean, attitudes have really changed. Two of my friends are executives in different national companies, and they were on planes all of the time. And when they first got grounded due to the pandemic, nobody wanted to leave. I mean, nobody, I mean, they was antsy. The wife was at home. They couldn't focus, you know. But eventually they settled in. And now the thought of going back, you know, spending all the time in the office, having all these corporate meetings, traveling here, traveling there. They've got really accustomed to working from home. And look, a lot of people have. A lot of broadcasters were broadcasting from home. I mean, you probably did the same thing. My sister-in-law is a school teacher. She, you know, she was teaching class from her home at some point. But look, that of course means that they're going to there's going to be an issue with a lot of empty real estate to deal with. Apple, on the other hand, they recently sent out a memo to their employees saying that they're going to require everyone to be in the office. At least, they say, for 3 days a week starting in the fall. And I want to talk about this coming up. Brent Oral is going to be stopping by in a second. We'll get his take on this. But, you know, if I owned a corporation, would I get greater productivity out of my employees being in office or having the convenience of working from home? I think it comes down to personality type. I really do. If you're driven and you're motivated, you know, you're going to get your job done. I mean, I work 24/7, whether I'm in the studio at the network or whether I'm at home, because I love what I do. And my job isn't a 4-letter word. It's not work. You know, it's a 3-letter word. It's joy. I really enjoy what I do. So I don't mind doing that. But there's a lot of people who check out and they should be doing their job. Meanwhile, they're taking a walk or they're doing their laundry or they're mowing their lawn or they're doing whatever, right? So how do you balance that? The announcement, by the way, for Apple did not go over very well with the employees. And there's been some serious pushback on it. I mean, other companies want to have their employees back in the office as well, primarily because there's a lot of empty office space right now that they're paying on. That's money going out the window. One analyst on CNBC explained why working from home, it has benefits, but it also has a downside as well. Now, I'd love to hear from you, share your reaction. I don't know whether you're still working at home or not. Listen to this report.
I think the new data are suggesting that anywhere from 1 to 2 days a week are going to be remote or flexible for most companies. Obviously, that doesn't include manufacturing or some kinds of service. But we've known for a long time that that flexibility is a benefit for motivation and productivity and retention. Even before the pandemic, there was an experiment showing that when people were randomly assigned to work from home, they were about 13.5% more productive and half as likely to quit over the next 6 to 9 months. And I think that's obviously good news for a lot of people. But those people who work from home, despite being more productive, were less likely to get promoted because they lacked face time with senior management. And I think that's a challenge that we're all going to have to navigate. What's going to happen to the people who don't necessarily have access to leaders at the top?
So a lot of great points there, right? Greater productivity. I think if the number you said was 13%, but less likely to get promoted. So something you may want to consider. What I found revealing is that some studies show that working from home is also causing a lot of stress for people. And that's bringing another phenomenon. People are just quitting their jobs, right? And they're looking for new employment. The Wall Street Journal, they reported on Labor Department statistics, which said that in April, the share of U.S. workers leaving jobs, it was 2.7%. That's a jump up from 1.6% a year earlier to the highest level since at least 2000. And actually, the numbers, they think, could actually go higher. Axios is reporting that surveys show that anywhere from 25% up to about 40% of workers are thinking about quitting their jobs. I find that number hard to get my head around. Really, a quarter to half of workers are thinking about quitting their jobs. You know what the reason was? The reason Axios reported is that workers, you know, they've had more than a year to consider work-life balance or career paths. And, you know, the world's opening back up and many of them are going to give their 2 weeks notice and make those changes they've been dreaming about. So I'm joined today to talk about it by Brent Oral. I'd love to hear from you too. He's a resident fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, where he works on job training and workforce development and criminal justice reform. And he's here for some perspective. Hey, Brent, thank you for your time. Good afternoon.
Well, it's great to be here. Thank you so much for having me on.
This, to me, is a very intriguing topic. I'm trying to understand it. I mean, I was reading somewhere that there are 1.9 million open positions right now currently available around the country, and companies right now are desperate to fill them. But with more people looking at leaving, those numbers could easily go up. I mean, what's going on in the workplace? And what do you make of those numbers I threw out? 25 to 40% of the current workforce wants to leave their job? I find that hard to get my head around.
Yeah, I think that is high. I think it is elevated by, as you said, you know, a year's worth of thinking, and also about career trajectories, and then also just, you know, it's a very robust labor market, right, for people with good skills, and there are just a lot of opportunities. So, yeah, I think there's a big reshuffle going on, and people rethinking their lives and thinking about new opportunities. And I think that's to be expected in the circumstances. The remote work issue is part of that. And one of the things that I just keep coming back to in this is that looking at today's labor force challenges, it's like a kaleidoscope, you know, of competing factors. You know, you look at it, it can absolutely drive you nuts trying to figure out where the main drivers are in people's employment decision making right now, and on the employer side as well. We don't really know what the future is going to be. It's like Yogi Berra said, you know, predictions are hard, especially about the future. Well, they are extremely hard right now, because there's so many different pieces in play on both the employer and the worker side as to these kinds of long-term decision-making.
Yeah, you know, a lot of decisions. We'll see how it all shakes out in the days ahead. I was struck by the fact that there's a 16% increase or 13% increase, I don't know the exact number, somewhere in the teens, of increased productivity from home. And, you know, as an employee, I owned my own business for a period of time, and it was small, but I had, you know, I'd want people in the office, you know, they're working, you know, they're executing, you know, they're not, you know, taking advantage of the clock. Yet we're seeing an increase in productivity from people working home. And, you know, first I thought, it doesn't make sense. But I know that when I, and I'll give you a personal example, you know, when I go into the radio network, when the pandemic was easing up, I'd go in to do the broadcast from our network headquarters, or I would broadcast from my remote studio, and I kind of split the days just because I didn't have to wear a mask at home. You know, the studio I did with everybody around. But I find that when I'm in the studio, people are stopping by my office, my phone is ringing more. I mean, I feel like my productivity in the office is less than when I am able to operate with less distractions. What do you attribute the increase in productivity to? Because there's a great temptation when you're at home, when you're bored or tired or hungry, to get up, to walk away from the desk, to go get something to eat, to cook something, to do something else that distracts you, to watch something. I mean, I would think working from home has its challenges too, yet we're seeing an increase in productivity. What do you attribute that to?
Well, I think it's going to take years to work out whether we actually had an increase in productivity. I think at the beginning of the pandemic, there was kind of an adrenaline surge, and people, you know, were working from home, uncertain about the future, what's going to happen to the economy as a result of lockdowns and school closures and so on. And so there was a lot of like I said, kind of an adrenaline rush, I think, that people really were working very hard, lots of extra hours. And I think that made people feel as if they were being more productive. Yeah. There's been some analysis that says, you know, the reason our productivity went up was that we had fewer workers. We had a massive spike in unemployment. And so we changed the denominator, and lo and behold, we got a big spike in productivity. So I think we're going to have to wait. There have been studies showing that there was an increase in productivity. There have been other studies showing not so much, actually, in terms of increases in productivity. And again, I think that'll, as we gather more data and kind of analyze it, I think we'll have a firmer grasp on whether working from home actually improves productivity.
You know what I find striking about that? You've got Apple that wants their people back, and you've got Facebook that says stay at home. So maybe the nature of the job determines,
yeah,
of course.
No, I think it's the nature of the job. I also think it's the culture of the business. You know, for instance, we've had several leaders of major financial corporations come forward and say everybody's going back. And uh, you you know, you'll have no excuse after the summer for not being in the office at Goldman Sachs or JP Morgan Bank. And this is just the way we do business. And if you're a hustler, you're going to be in the office.
Right.
And I think that is something of a, yeah. you know, a cultural thing in the finance sector, because there are other banks, for instance, Deutsche Bank yeah. has said, no, we're going to stay with hybrid and we're going to let people, you know, be in the office a couple days a week. And I think what that signals to me is that there's going to be some pretty fierce competition in some sectors for highly skilled workers who want to make a point out yeah. of work.
Yeah, that makes sense. Well, my guest today, Brett Orel, if you want to join us, feel free to dial in. Love to hear from you. Maybe you run your business. Maybe you're split between the idea. Feel free to sound off. It's 888-914-9149, 888-914-9149. You can get into the conversation. Nick is listening in Frankfort, Illinois. Hi, Frank.
Hello, it's Nick from Frankfort, Illinois. How you doing,
you know, I'm sorry, Nick. Your name is clear on the screen. That was me. How you doing, Nick?
I am doing great, great, great. Thanks. You know, talking about the polls and all, and whether it's productive from home or versus not. What about a good poll on our spiritual life? What has it done to our spiritual life to be at home like this? And you know, you think about all the lockdowns and whatnot, and not being able to have access to mass in certain places. And mm-hmm. it was a blessing to be at home because my parish was open and I was able to get to daily mass every day. Whereas if I had to go downtown, I would not have been able to go to adoration every day because St. Peter's was closed. I wouldn't be able yeah. to get to mass every day. So you know, I think through that spiritual life, our productivity can be weighed whether it's good or not compared to whether our spiritual life is good or not. We got to get that spiritual part of our day right before anything else is right. And I thank God for the opportunity to grow spiritually during this crazy time.
Yeah, no doubt. Hey, Nick, thank you. That's a great insight. You know, for me, I'm uniquely blessed because at the Relevant Radio headquarters, we have a chapel probably a few doors away from my main entrance. So I'm able to go to Mass daily and visit the Blessed Sacrament if I want to. But you're right. I mean, the spiritual life, there's a lot of, you know, pros and cons people have found. Brent, depending on where they work and what they were able to do. I was surprised to see that stress levels were up working from home. I thought that would have been a little less. I've got to take a break, but give me your thoughts on that. Why would stress levels be higher at home rather than in the office?
Well, everybody has a different experience in terms of working from home. That's one of our challenges. We can't really generalize very much. I think that there are for some groups of people who maybe have smaller homes or living in multi-generational households or, you know, were responsible for seeing to the education of their children while schools were closed and so on and so on. It could be really stressful and it could extend the working day a good deal if you're having to care for someone, yeah. a parent or child during the day, and then in the evening you still have to get your work done. So I can easily imagine circumstances in which it was very stressful. Personally, I found it was great. I was more productive at home. I did a lot more writing, reading, thinking than I have typically been able to do in the office. At the same time, I'm really looking forward to being back in the office because of the social contact that it provides.
No, I agree. It's good to be back with everyone. They're kind of a second family to you, too, when you're there. But you bring up a good point. I only have a minute on this one. Is we're seeing the economy reopen. You know, employers want their employees back. This is now becoming a challenge for a lot of parents. I mean, initially, when it first took place, they had to be at home, try to do their work, balance their you know, the schooling of their children. But child care centers, they have a shortage of workers, and that's a real problem for a lot of parents now trying to go back to school and deal with their kids. So a lot of hurdles to face. Huh? So how does parenting and kids factor into this?
I think it's huge. You know, when you break down the numbers, like who wants to go back and who prefer to be home, right. The number of women saying that they want to be home, either full-time or mostly at home, are far higher than they are for men. The, you know, like 50% to 20%. So you know, I think there has been a realization that working from home actually affords, in addition to its stresses, affords some opportunities for, particularly for people who are engaged in caregiving for others, children again, or adults. And so it's, you know, it's allowed people to have a taste of a lifestyle that has in the past been the province of very few and select number of people. And I think that people really, in many cases, have liked it. And I think that's going to be a major driver here. Again, we've got a labor shortage going on. Employers have lost some of their leverage over this question. They're going to have to negotiate resolutions to this challenge, or people will just go elsewhere.
All right, my guest today, Brent Orrell. We're taking a look at working from home, the changing landscape, if you will, of the future work. You know, will you be able to continue to work from home? Do you have to get back to the office? Will it be a hybrid version of it all? How does it affect productivity, family life, and so much more? If you want to sound off, you can get in. I have Brent for a few minutes. Number here is 888-914-9149. I'll be back with more right after this.
The Order of Foresters is proud to sponsor the relevant radio studio line. For information about employment opportunities and flexible premium life insurance plans, visit relevantradio.com/Forester.
The Chaplet of Divine Mercy begins soon on Relevant Radio.
Well, thanks for joining me. If you are just getting plugged in, we're taking a look at the changing landscape of working from home. Most of America had to do that. You see those haunting shots of cities around the nation with no cars on them. And normally it's bumper to bumper. Most people were grounded for months due to COVID-19. And now that majority of the population is beginning to get vaccinated and companies are opening up, mask mandates are being dropped, we are now seeing a change. Some companies are saying, we want you back in the office. Others like Facebook are saying, hey, you can work remotely. And some are saying we want a hybrid. We want a mix of both. I'm joined this afternoon by Brent Orrell. He's a resident fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. You can check them out. They're writing about this. You'll get some great resources at AEI.org. And he works on everything from workforce development to job training and so much more. And Brent, we only have a couple minutes here. I just want to follow up on another point or two. And I think about the different generations. You know, the millennial generation could very easily adapt, I think, to working from home, from dealing with computer screens and all the rest. Maybe that older demo had a more difficult time. Maybe not. I don't know. I'm curious as to whether or not there is a generational split and how the different generations have responded to the changing landscape and how that's going to change moving forward.
Yeah, I'll never forget the day that we were told here at AEI that we were going remote, and a couple of the people on my team approached me to ask, how long do you think this will last? And at that, they said, it's only going to be a couple of weeks, right? I said, I think we're out for a while. And they said, well, what's a while? And I said, I think it's going to be at least 8 weeks. And it turned into it over a year. And their faces really fell.
You know, you don't have to convert everyone that you go up against.
Live, interactive, and in the moment. Relevant Radio.
But you do say everything in love, and they'll see that in you, and they'll be less aggressive if you do it in a manner which would make Christ proud of you.
Right.
Guest host, Jim Burnham.
I think we have two absolute trump cards available to us. And one, is, as you mentioned, is love. We have kindness. And I see a massive lack of kindness and respect and, you know, desire for true dialogue on the other side of the culture divide. And the other thing we have is we have a sense of humor. We can't lose sight of the joy that should animate our efforts.
I love what you just said. I mean, humor. I mean, I have to use it every day or I'm going to go crazy.
Yeah, absolutely.
I've got tape around my head if I don't laugh at these crazy things.
Bringing Christ to the world through the media.
There is truth, and the truth is in the Lord's teaching.
This is Relevant Radio.
Getting you connected. This is the Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
My thanks to Brett Orrell there, and we'll continue to monitor the changing landscape of how things are working. Before I pray the chaplet today, we're going to do that in about 5 minutes. I just wanted to share a phone call. I got a lot of email from a listener who called the Chaplet of Divine Mercy yesterday. If you missed the conversation, let me just share with you this particular call. It dealt with hair loss, really, but I got a lot of response, and I thought maybe I'd share it because it might help you as well. Here's part of the chaplet from yesterday. Listen.
I am just been sick since my daughter's been born, likely some mold illness and hormonal stuff, but doctors can't figure it out, and I've kind of given doctors a break. They just kind of tossed me off with anxiety, but I have developed many allergies, more than I can even keep track of, and I haven't been able to eat a warm meal with my family. I have to eat my own, I call it my frozen space food, but I'm grateful for it. And I can't stop losing my hair, and it's causing me, I know it sounds really minor, but no, it's really bad, and it's been going on. Yeah. And it's every shampoo, everything I put on my hair, and I have a scalp condition, and it just breaks off, and I just get in agony over it, and also struggle with my mental health. My family left on a trip to Colorado, and I had to forego it because I couldn't figure out a way to get safe food with all my allergies, and I just want to live and enjoy life, and I believe that God wants me to do that, but it just I just really want relief and healing.
So her name was Melissa, and you could hear how difficult her situation was. And a lot of people responded. I just want to share a couple of the emails. And Melissa, if you're listening, I actually have a phone number for you from somebody who wrote. One person named Linda wrote, she says, I'm reaching out to your caller, Melissa, on today's show. She's a woman who's apparently a frequent caller, but was very despondent about losing her hair and developing multiple food allergies, depression, and many other symptoms. She says it's possible she has Hashimoto's, an autoimmune disease that can happen after trauma, like childbirth. If you have any way to reach her, give her this information so the doctor can check her thyroid antibodies. Please do so. You may also give her my name and contact information. I'm a health coach, and I'd be more than glad to help. I'm retired. I charge I'm retired and charge nothing to help with my support. And I've got great resources that can help her overcome this terrible condition. So, Melissa, if you're listening, I have that number, and my board operator will be more than glad to give that number to you. Another person called and says, hey, I heard that troubling story of the woman with her hair breaking off, had many allergies after having a baby. Her name's Melissa. If you can contact her anyway, tell her that there's a great product out there called Olaplex. My wife is a salon owner and does Olaplex treatments on damaged hair. It really works. It's not a conditioner. It actually rebuilds the disulfide bonds of the damaged hair. I hope I said that right. The damage is mostly done by color services process and bleaching. And she says it possibly could have went wrong, and the person goes through on that. So you might want to check out Olaplex, O-L-A-P-L-E-X. One final email here, too, on this issue. This person said, when I lost my hair due to cancer, I would remember the following. There was once a woman who woke up one morning, looked in the mirror, and noticed that she had three hairs on her head. Well, she said, I think I'll braid my hair today. So she did. She had a wonderful day. The next day, she woke up and looked in the mirror, and she saw that she had only two hairs on her head. She said, I think I'll part my hair down the middle today. So she did. And she had a grand day. The next day she woke up, she looked in the mirror and noticed that she had only one hair on her head. Well, she said, today I'm going to wear my hair in a ponytail. So she did. And she had a fun day. Well, the next day she woke up, she looked in the mirror and noticed that there wasn't a single hair on her head. Yay, she exclaimed. I don't have to fix my hair today. This person says, attitude is everything. As the saying goes, there's kind of life that you have that is not determined by what happens to you. It's determined by your reaction to what happens to you. So this person says, have a good day. Be kinder than necessary for everyone you meet is fighting some kind of battle. And I thought that was insightful as well. It may not give Melissa a whole lot of comfort, but it might help you. I mean, we look at our situation, the glass is either half full or it's half empty, right? All depends how you look at it. I prefer to look at life half full, even when things are difficult, right? I know that God can bring a greater good out of them. So let's pray for Melissa. Melissa, if you're listening, you can call my call screeners. I have some of that information and some of those numbers for you. If you want to join me for the Chaplet of Divine Mercy, let me give you the number. You might be new to it. Maybe you read my book and said, hey, I want to check this guy out and this prayer he talks about. The number to get in is 888-914-9149. 888-914-9149, and we will pray the chaplet together. Got some great answered prayers to share with you. There's some very important petitions that I'd like you to pray for as well, and we'll share all of them ahead. And you know, I know many of you have your book. I was talking to Rose at the front desk, and she says a lot of people who may not have gotten their book actually entered some of the information in wrong, and she's trying to track them down to get that right so they'll be able to send out those books. But a lot of incredible results, a lot of great conversion coming as a result of the book on Divine Mercy. It's a Divine Mercy is a gift for our time, and I'm honored to be able to pray with you. So when we come back, let's pray together. Pray for you.